Southern trees bear strange fruit. Blood on the leaves.
Good morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, food, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones. No relation, by the way. On today's episode, we welcome Sidney Morrison, author of Frederick Douglass, a novel from Portland's Hawthorne Books. Sidney's book is a fictionalized account of the life of Frederick Douglass, a former slave who became instrumental in ending slavery in the U.S. and who many consider one of the greatest Americans of the 19th century. Sidney has been working on this book for over 40 years, finishing the first version in 1978. The published volume is version number 3 and portrays the very human side of Douglass, his friends and family, including the influential women in his life, as well as his former colleagues and enemies. Both Douglass and the history of his time come alive in these pages. Sidney's a retired teacher of history and English and school principal, one of the few principals who served at the elementary, middle, and high school levels. He now works as a part-time educational consultant and leadership coach in school districts in Southern California. Frederick Douglass, a novel, is Sidney's first book. Karen Joy Fowler calls it an important work about an important man and America, meticulously researched, deeply imagined, and engagingly told. Please join us for our conversation with Sidney, which is already in progress. Well, Sidney, thanks for taking time to talk with us today while you're here in Portland.
Well, thank you so much for the invitation. I very much appreciate it, because the opportunity to talk about my novel is a blessing, and so here I am.
And we're fortunate to have you here today.
Thank you so much.
Now, the book goes back 40 years, I so.
Yes,
I
it think does.
So. So let's start there around 1978. You were a teacher of history and English at the time.
Yes, I was. I was a high school history and English teacher. And I finished my first version of this novel in 1978. I even actually didn't realize I had done that until I found a book a few years ago that had a congratulatory note saying, "Sidney, I'm so proud that you finished your book," and it was dated November 1978, and I gasped.
Oh, somebody who read the
yes,
manuscript?
That's right, and I didn't realize it was that long ago. I had forgotten, but I did write this first version in 1978. I obtained a literary agent because of that version, and the version was 1,300 pages, and I had to have it typed because I wrote it in longhand. And then it was sent into the world by this agent, and it was rejected again and again and again.
And her name was
Kimberly Cameron. Right. Yes, okay. And she still
you
has
her in the book.
Yes, and she still has a very successful agency in Northern California in Tiburon, and she made a decision to not have me as a client, and it turned out to be a good thing, because I have now an agent who has successfully found a publisher for the book.
And that's Stephen Scholl.
That's
and
Stephen
the publisher
Scholl.
For, yes. Hughes, and, who we'll
yeah,
talk about.
Yeah, with Hawthorne.
Yes, I want to say, based on teaching history and English, you found a nice blend of your interest in historical fiction. And at your Powell's event, you mentioned reading books as a kid, The Last of the Mohegans, Three Musketeers, mm-hmm. both somewhat historical fiction, melodramatic.
Yes, yes.
And you were a big fan, as I was, of the classic illustrated comics.
Yes.
Man, that was my, I think I read Moby Dick that
that's,
night.
That's how and, I read most of the classics first with Classics Illustrated. And then I moved on to reading the books themselves, and I had a library nearby. And also my mother loved reading historical fiction. And so I asked if I could read her books, and I just became enamored of history through that vehicle. And I wrote a historical novel because I know it's a popular genre, and that people's introduction to history is often through that. And I'm still hoping that because of this historical novel, more and more people will learn about the history of not only Frederick Douglass's time.
But Frederick Douglass and his time and the history of the country.
And the history of the country. century. Very important period. I specialized in the antebellum period when I was a student of history at UCLA. And it's a crucial period for understanding who we are today. And so when I was a teacher, I really wanted my students to see their active role in creating history, because history is narrative and study and selection and deciding what it means for you. And I wanted to empower my students to feel that they could be historians. Uh-huh. And at first they resisted because they just wanted multiple choice tests and not write essays and do research. But I brought them around. I loved teaching history when I was in high school as a teacher.
Now, since the process of writing the book goes back 40 years, you've had a long time fascination with the life of Frederick Douglass. How were you first introduced to the man and his work? At Powell's, you said you read a book called There Once Was a Slave, The Heroic Story of Frederick Douglass. I looked it up. It's by Shirley Graham.
That's right.
It came out in 1947. But you said it wasn't quite the impression of the man you wanted. He was portrayed a little too saint-like?
Yes. Yes, I read that book. And interesting enough, that was the year of my birth, 1947. Mm-hmm. But years later, I came across this book. And even then, I was unsatisfied as an early reader because it portrayed Frederick Douglass as a virtual saint. And I just felt that this is not accurate, and also it is not helpful to pretend or to present someone in that kind of light. And I presumed out of my arrogance that I could do better. And so I decided that I wanted to write a better version of Frederick Douglass's life. And so it was a motivation in an odd way that I felt that if you're going to write about such an important figure, you should be honest about
the warts and all the
warts and all the complexity, the contradictions. It was so satisfying for years later for me to discover that James Baldwin wrote a searing critique of that book in The Nation. Uh-huh. And he was in his early 20s. And I quote a passage from that book in the acknowledgement sources section in the novel, because it really validated that the approach of treating iconic figures as saints is not helpful. And also it is damaging, because when you set people up as saints, you are basically telling people that their capacity to get better and to improve is useless and worthless. And I really feel that people should know that we all can get better and we don't have to strive for perfection.
Yeah, it's an unreachable ideal.
Yes.
I mean, that's the way we were taught about George Washington.
That's Abraham right.
Lincoln, Thomas Jefferson,
yes.
Who was a slaveholder.
Yes.
But we weren't taught that as
no.
kids.
No. Yeah. And I think people can handle complexity, although some people fear that if we show the warts of iconic figures, that somehow we're betraying their status or undermining their status. And I don't think that is so. I think most people appreciate the humanity of very important figures, even though I have to remember and honestly say that when I discovered some of the flaws of Martin Luther King Jr., who I admired greatly and whose death devastated me in 1968, because I was a student at UCLA when he was assassinated, to discover that he had issues with adultery, I just was shocked. I had a hard time incorporating those two realities. But over time, I matured, I think, and realized that you can be a great person and have flaws.
Now, looking at your source material, it wasn't There Once Was a Slave, The Heroic Story of Frederick Douglass, obviously. He himself wrote three
yes.
autobiographies, A Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass, an American Slave, that was 1845, My Bondage and My Freedom, 1855, and finally, Life and Times of Frederick Douglass, 1882, so about 13 years before he died. Mm-hmm. You said you prefer the first by far, and quote, it matches the achievement of contemporary Americans known for single works, Thoreau for Walden, Melville for Moby Dick, or my classics mm-hmm. illustrated version, Hawthorne for The Scarlet Letter, and Harriet Beecher Stowe for Uncle Tom's Cabin. That first book then must have really struck a nerve for you.
Yes, it did, because I believe that it is a masterpiece of literature of the 19th century, and that when you read it, you find a compelling narrative of self-discovery and the desire to be free. It's shorter than the other two books, and it comes soon after his escape. And so there's an immediacy about the narrative that is less so in the later books. Now, the second book, My Bondage and My Freedom, gives more details about the story that he told in the first version.
And in the book, you make it clear that Douglas himself thought his first version may have been a little too, too melodramatic.
Because he knew he had to write it to justify himself, and it was part of the mission of the anti-slavery movement to him, to have him write this book. And so you could say, in the study of that time, of that literature of that time, that it was almost like propaganda, that it was deliberately written to consciously depict slavery in a certain way. And because of that, it, for some people, might say that it's distorted. And
unfortunately, and not though.
Yes, it's not.
He didn't make things up.
Yeah, he did not make things up. But his unequivocal attack on slavery is what really makes for compelling reason for reading. But what's interesting is that over time, over the course of three books, he made some variations in how he told his story. For example, in his first narrative, he openly and unequivocally says, "I was born in Tuckahoe, Maryland, and my father was a white man." In the second, and then he also says, "When I received the news of my mother's death, I received it as I was the news of the death of a stranger." Then when he writes his second book, My Bondage and My Freedom, his mother is the person who taught him his letters. His mother is this gifted person, and he fills in details, which I will argue was his fantasy of his mother.
Yeah, you don't have that story in the book.
And so his
mother was fairly distant.
Yes, and she was part of his life only on six occasions at night. And most of the time when she came, he was sleeping, so he barely knew her. But you would not know that from the second version of his autobiography. And so in order to get a really good sense of Douglas and the way he changed in his own self-perception, you need to read all three versions and make comparisons. And one of the things I pointed out in my talk at Powell's was that you will notice that he barely mentions his wife of 44 years.
Yeah, we'll get into that, because a big part of the book for you was bringing to life the women in his life.
That's right.
Which you don't find in his autobiography.
That's right.
There's scant mention of that.
Yes.
Now, I got to get the main question out of the way.
Okay.
And I know you get it over and over, and you got it at Powell's, or you addressed it before you got the question. Mm-hmm. And you address it in the sources and acknowledgments section at the end of Frederick Douglass, the novel. Why did you write an historical novel and not a biography?
It is a question that I'm consistently asked, and I think
first one that came to my mind.
And it's a question that most historical novelists are asked. There was a time in the period of the past, I think, 200 years, where the historical fiction was considered as somewhat dubious and illegitimate, especially in the academic community. Although historical fiction has been part of American and Western culture for a couple of centuries. Nevertheless, the question is, why write a historical novel rather than a biography?
Especially given all your research.
That's right. And fortunately for me, Frederick Douglass was a very well-known, he was a very well-known public figure. And so his life, in terms of his speaking engagements, his speeches, and his own writing, it was very public. And thanks to the research of many, many his scholars, we know his public life from the moment he emerged in 1841 to his death in 1895. And that's a real boon for a researcher, really a real boon for a researcher. On the other hand, his life is almost fundamentally known because of what he said about it
in through the
his private life. Uh-huh. We know about his public life and what he felt about his private life in his autobiographies. And many public figures didn't even do that much. But the 19th century was a time when many, many people, highly educated or not, wrote letters and kept diaries. So the 19th century is just a treasure trove.
It's not a lot of tweets and emails.
That's right. And so there's a lot there. But there's also a lot of absences. There's a lot of erasures. And in Douglass's case, he wrote about his public life, but rarely about his private life and his private feelings. And I noticed certain gaps in his story. And I decided that what I wanted to do was fill in those gaps with imagined dialogue, with imagined reflection of thinking of characters. And biographers can't do that. They can read the documents, and they can summarize if they have the documents,
they
like
can't
letters.
Fictionalize either.
They cannot make up dialogue.
No.
They cannot say this person thought this. But writers of historical fiction can, and make no claim for the novel as being the truth or definitive version of a life. I highly recommend to readers who love historical fiction to read to listen to the lectures on historical fiction by Hilary Mantel.
That was my next question.
Yes.
Yeah, actually, I know she's one of your literary heroes and a role model. This was in a really good interview you did for the journal Forward.
Yes.
And her advice is to explore what you don't know.
Yes.
I guess what you can't learn from the historical accounts is what she's getting at. We often hear that fiction can be used to express a higher truth,
yes,
which I think she's also implying here. But how do you balance those explorations with staying true to the man and his life?
Yes, one of the things that Hilary Mantel points out, that historical novelists are granted the gift of characters who existed, even granted the gift of the plot. So you know what happens. And so you don't have to figure out point A to point B. If you're true to the historical record, you don't have someone at the Battle of Gettysburg when they weren't there, or at the Alamo or the Bastille. You may have wanted them to be there, but if you're really true to the historical record, you don't do that. And then, on the other hand, you are free to use your characters to express the feelings that you think they would have expressed in their lives. And you are doing this as a way to resurrect their feelings and their thoughts, with the understanding that it's your resurrection, it is your story, and you are not making any claims to that this is the version that must be.
But again, there's that question in your head, am I being true to Frederick Douglass? Am I being true to his wife, Anna?
That's right.
You make up a lot of dialogue for
and
her.
For example, with Anna, I was fascinated by the fact that he ignored her in his books. I was fascinated by the fact that there's very little said about her in the record, and that their daughter, Rosetta, was so concerned that her mother would be lost to history. She wrote a brief pamphlet about her mother, but she waited till both of her parents died before she did it. And that's all we know about Anna as far as how she was as a mother, where she was from. And then
Well, her childhood, too. In the book, you have her a victim of her father raped her.
Yes.
Or was that in Rosetta's?
No, was not. And so I got some background, and I wanted to speculate why she was like she was and what happened to her.
Sexual abuse as a kid.
And yes, because the father was, according to the information we had, was very difficult human being. And there was that kind of treatment of daughters in 19th century in many, many respects. So I speculated. I am not claiming that I have proof that she was molested by her father. But I was willing to speculate that perhaps some of the reasons as to why she was so controlling as a person and why she was so rigid was because of what happened to her as a child. And again, I have nothing to prove that this happened, and I don't claim that it happened. I just, for my own purposes as a writer of a novel, decided that it happened.
And it seems very credible. I want to go into another instance too, Sydney, where, and it's the opening scene in the book.
Mm-hmm.
So Douglass is speaking at a church. It's 1844. He's 6 years out of bondage.
Yes.
And I think 3 years into somewhat of a career as a lecturer
That's
and a
right.
journalist. And he faces down a heckler in the audience who doesn't believe someone so intelligent and articulate could have been a slave.
Right.
It was not uncommon criticism of Douglas then.
Yes, right.
Sadly, his background as a slave was very real.
Yes.
But in the scene, you add a touch that apparently is not in the historical records. I wonder if you could talk about that and your reasons for it.
Yes.
Kind of dramatizing it. I guess what I'm getting at, it seems like it's a way of bringing us through fiction to a higher truth.
Yes, because the higher truth that I wanted to grapple with is how do you authenticate yourself? And clearly from the historical record, in The Liberator, which is quoted in that opening prologue, he was doubted as an authentic slave.
By an abolitionist, yeah, William even, Garrison.
Yes, even the abolitionists,
right.
They were willing to accept that he was a runaway slave, but they found that his articulate speech was somewhat undermining of the claim that he was a legitimate slave.
Which is as racist as it gets.
Yes, yes, clearly so. And it got worse. And so, but he refused to dumb down his speech. And so reading that this was a common occurrence because of the racism of that time, both in North and South, he had to defend himself. And I wondered about having such an opening as the one I dramatized when he said at one point in one of his letters that he wished he had done that, showed his scars. And so for me, for having a dramatic opening, knowing that he was challenged a lot publicly, knowing that he mocked sermons of ministers using religion to defend slavery, knowing that he wished that he had done it, but there was no record that he had, all those elements added up for me an opportunity to dramatize an incident that could have happened in most respects, but in one respect did not. And that's often what historical novelists have to do. You know, what are you trying to achieve with this combination of fact and also imagination? And for me, I wanted to establish his character, his strength of purpose, his willingness to counter verbal attacks, and there are many, many records, thankfully, of his countering these verbal attacks. He was really a very, very aggressive person with speech, if he had to be, which is why I made this reference to his being
able
to.
So it's very believable.
Yes, because he, and even in his detailed version of his life in Baltimore, he admitted that he could curse like a dock worker. And he actually, because he talked back, even when he was a slave, he got beaten up. To one point, he almost lost his eye because he was called a name when he was told to do a job. And he told these white men, "You do it. I'm not your slave." And they and then he punched someone, and it was like,
"Oh, that's when he was working in the shipyards."
That's right. And that was clearly not supposed to happen. So he was a very dramatic person himself, and I thought that all those factors I could bring together in this opening scene to show this is the man that I want you to know. That
I loved it because as all good fiction does, and this is historical fiction, it's not historical biography.
Right. Yet.
You portray Douglas as a fully rounded character, which you got into, so you don't shy away from his flaws. Yeah. He's not a saint.
Right.
He does have this quickness to anger. Some of it's righteous anger.
Right.
Anger,
yes, right.
Anger nonetheless.
Yes.
Lack of forgiveness. He makes a lot of enemies.
Yes, right.
And a pride bordering at times on arrogance. So definitely not saint-like. There's one story which I thought was maybe the good part of pride and maybe showed his desire, his determination to be himself.
Yes.
To be who he was, and that was how he got his name.
Yes.
He was originally Frederick Bailey.
Yes.
And then he came up with another alias, and I think when he was freed, they wanted to change his name to Frederick Johnson, or he did.
Yes.
And he was advised, no, how about Douglas? You know,
right.
There's too many Johnsons around.
Right.
So he said, okay, but I want two S's.
That's right.
Yeah. And what does he say about that last S?
That is my S.
Right. Yeah.
And he describes that selection in the second book. And the second book, again, is unfamiliar to most readers. Because remember, he did not describe in his first book his life as a free man, because he did not want to let people know how he escaped. So his story in his first book is about his enslavement. But the second book is also about his life as a free man and his discovery about discrimination in the North, and also that in the North, there were many people, including black people, who were willing to accept money for the return of fugitive slaves.
Yes, that was interesting. Yes. Even though he was free, he was constantly watching his back. He could have been kidnapped and sent back to the
South. That's right. He was technically still a slave until 1846. And so when he arrived in New York, he was told that there were what were called blackbirders who were willing to just turn black people in so they can make money.
And this is in New York.
And this is in New York, which he planned to live in. But he was encouraged to not stay. And so he was encouraged to go further north to a town he never heard of, New Bedford, Massachusetts. And his wedding certificate has him as Frederick Johnson.
Oh.
And his wife is Anna Johnson, because they took Anna Murray Johnson. And then when they got to New Bedford, he said, no, there are too many Johnsons, and maybe you need to change your name. And also many people don't realize, and didn't realize until later, that the record shows that Frederick's name, his complete name, was a Frederick Augustus Washington Bailey. And so when he went to New York, he added Johnson, and then he had to change Johnson to Douglas, but added an S. And because it was Douglas based on a poem by Sir Walter Scott, who was someone he began to read, he thought it was a good thing that he took the name of an iconic Scottish hero.
Now, to write Douglas's story, Douglas with two S's, you not only had to research the man and his life, but the times he lived in.
That's right.
And the people he interacted with. And there are many in the book, some well-known to people who know history and some more obscure, even to people who read history. How do you immerse yourself in the time and place and famous figures? I'll give just a few. William Lloyd Garrison, that abolitionist who had a bit of racism in him. John Brown, the violent abolitionist. Harriet Beecher Stowe, Uncle Tom's Cabin. Senator Charles Sumner, who had an interesting relationship, complex relationship with Douglas. And then a lot of presidents. Lincoln, Johnson, Grant, Garfield, and even Chester A. Arthur.
That's right.
Who Douglas met with.
That's right.
He knew them personally.
Well, actually, Douglas met with all of them. And that meant for me more research. And one of the things that biographers must do is that when they make claims, they must support it with documentation, which is why if you look at a biography, there's a lot of footnotes or back notes. Because if you make any claim, you are going to be challenged by fellow academicians if you don't have documentation to prove that he believed or felt something. And if you have sources that are highly prolific in terms of letters or speeches, then you have a stronger case. But novels come out of the deficiencies of history. That is, novels are written because there are gaps where the documentation doesn't exist.
And that's where the novelists, like you and Hilary Mantel,
feel that this is... You are actually liberated by the absences of those documents. On the other hand, we must immerse ourselves in the period so that we can feel that we're living it. And so that when we do write the novel, we are bringing to life these characters like Garrison, like John Brown, like the president. So what that required for me is to read biographies of all these people and also read their letters if they wrote them. And so I had to immerse myself in the 19th century, not only in the history of politics, but also in what food did they eat? How did they bathe? How did they travel? How did it feel to be on a horse or in a stuffy carriage? And all of this has to become part of the way you capture the past.
Because you're bringing it alive.
Because you're bringing it to life for people who don't know. Fortunately, as I said earlier, many of the figures in the book were highly prolific in explaining themselves and interacting with each other. Garrison, for example, wrote hundreds and hundreds of letters.
Well, he published The Liberator.
So he published The Liberator.
A very productive journalist.
But to discover the racism in his private letters was very upsetting. But that was a revelation that I had to somehow incorporate into the drama of the story. And fortunately, there was a complete breakdown between Garrison, who was Frederick's mentor, and Douglas himself, because Douglas outgrew the role that they assigned to him. He was supposed to give speeches, and he was very good at it. But he wanted to do more.
Start his own
newspaper.
Garrison didn't care for that.
And Garrison was not happy about this. And then on the other hand, when he got involved with someone like John Brown, John Brown was also very busy writing and appealing for money. And in fact, when he was captured at Harper's Ferry, he had letters from Douglas that implicated Douglas, who rejected Brown's invitation to go to Harper's Ferry.
But he still had to get out of the country.
Yeah, because he had to get out of the country because Brown had these letters that implicated Douglas. And so with all that information, you have to distill a great deal. You have to reject a lot of letters to quote and speeches to quote. And it was very, very challenging, which is why I understand the book was so long in the first place. Because I wanted to leave everything in, but you can't. And so the only way that you could successfully write a novel that is not burdened with a lot of information is to focus on the characters and how they felt and how they said and things and spoke to each other in scenes. And that is how I wrote my novel. I wrote it as a series of scenes.
Yeah, and you did it in third person from these multiple points of view.
Yes.
So it's called third person close,
That's right.
Where you're getting into the head of the person you're writing about. But what was interesting, Sydney, at Powell's, you mentioned the first draft was in first person.
That's right.
And then you change it to third, which I think is very successful. But I at some points, I'm just thinking it must have been difficult for you. There's one where Douglas's original owner and his possible biological father, a white man, Captain Aaron Anthony, is brutally whipping Frederick's aunt, Hester Bailey.
Yes.
And I think Frederick's watching this.
Yes, he is.
And you not only graphically describe the physical and verbal abuse that Anthony's giving Hester, but in this case, from the perspective of the slaveholder, the person dishing it out, not receiving it, that must have been tough emotionally to get into the head of somebody so villainous.
Yes.
I'd use the word evil.
Yes, and that's the challenge, that if you're going to write without prejudice in the sense that you're going to write with some effort to understand the viciousness of such an act, that number one, you are describing someone who's consciously, deliberately beating someone who was a lesson for children, and also an expression of his own sexual frustration, because in his later book,
she was being beaten because she was seeing
another slave. And that's described in more detail in his second book than in his first. But he was traumatized by the scene itself. And so I wanted to dramatize that more graphically, his sexual frustration and his rage. And so I had to give him words in that particular scene.
But you also get inside his head.
That's right.
What he's not expressing verbally, but he's thinking.
That's right.
And he's rationalizing.
That's right. Why he's doing what he's doing.
She deserves the beating.
That's right.
He can't let them get away with this.
That's right. Yes. And so as a novelist writing in first person only, I restricted myself to the point of view of Frederick. And even as I was writing that first version, I found myself bound by that point of view, and I wanted to get into the head of his enslavers and the other people in his life.
But so difficult.
But it's very difficult. So, because you have to really go deeply into understanding abuse and even violence. And so I also read a great deal literature, psychological literature about violence and abusers and people and murderers. And I really, in order to succeed, I had to grant myself permission to become them, so that I could be that person.
Like an actor playing a serial killer.
Yes,
or something.
And
like,
if we don't do that, then we're left with autobiography. Sometimes people will tell us, will say, write what you know. And I would say, well, there would only be autobiographies. How do are we going to be writers if we restrict ourselves to our own experience? Shakespeare didn't do that. Dickens didn't do that. Dostoevsky didn't do that. And Dostoevsky wrote a novel about murderers. And he wasn't a murderer. And so the idea that you have to only write about what you experience is not true to the nature of art. You have to be willing to become what you're not.
Maybe the most discomforting part of that is that to discover that we're all capable of something like that. That's inside maybe all of us, and it's just a matter of circumstances, events, and it could come out.
Quite honestly.
And you don't want it to.
Quite honestly, it scared me. Uh-huh. It scared me that in the end of describing some of these scenes, I could imagine myself doing it, feeling that kind of rage, and that scared me. But I have to be honest enough to also recognize that within human beings, it's a whole range of emotions that are possible because of circumstances and the choices that we make.
Exactly.
You know, and so if you're willing to go there, then you're willing to, I think, have some expansion of empathy and connection. And we are then able to write historical fiction that's not autobiographical, because all of the great writers, I believe, create characters who are not themselves, and themselves in both ways. But it's that effort to be empathetic with Aaron Anthony, who I believe was his biological father. And I also, because I believe that he was his biological father, it explains some other events that happened in his life as to why he was sent to Baltimore, Frederick was sent to Baltimore 3 times. And I think this was some special intervention in that family of his daughter that made this all possible. And I wanted to show that in the story. And that even grants some measure of empathy to Aaron Anthony. But for some people, that's an empathy that should not be granted. And Douglas himself received a lot of criticism when he returned to Maryland in 1878 and saw his former enslaver, who was the son-in-law of Aaron Anthony, Thomas Auld.
Thomas Auld.
That's right.
Yes. Now, you thought of the book, I think you've said that, at Powell's, as kind of writing a fourth autobiography.
Yes. Which was really arrogant.
But with some significant additions.
Yeah.
Which may be even more arrogant. Yeah. His life's not good enough. One big one was your goal, Sidney, to give life and praise to the women in Douglas's life. And
yes.
We've already talked about his wife, Anna Murray. There was little information on these strong and influential women, especially his grandmother, Betsy
yes.
Bailey, and his wife, Anna Murray Douglas, mm-hmm. who his wife of 44 years and actually responsible for him escaping
yes.
slavery. She
yes.
was a free woman.
Yes.
She had resources that he had no access to on his own.
Yes.
How'd you go about writing them and giving them life on the page? You said with Anna Murray, there's basically just Rosetta's
pamphlet.
Brief.
That's right. But I got enough from that pamphlet to suggest to me that she was a strong woman. And also by the fact that she, a free woman, chose to help the escape of a slave. That to me indicated that she had a will of her own. And then...
And a lot of courage.
And a lot of courage. And in the letters of their children, they talk about their mother as being very strong, very controlling, very demanding that they behave in a certain way. So I got the impression that this woman was someone who was strong. And I fortunately had an example of, in my life, of strong women, my wife, my mother, my grandmother,
Karen's
her daughters.
And I
felt that he was who he was because of the influence of his grandmother, in one respect, in that he was raised by her for 6 years without his knowledge of being a slave. And so he had a sense of self and confidence that led to him believing that he was special. And when he was left with his slave master by his grandmother without explanation, he was deeply traumatized. But I do believe that those first 6 years, which as an educator I can say, are primary in the development of human personality, he carried that example with him. And I think because of that example of not only his grandmother, but of his aunts and his interaction with his sister Eliza, that he depended on and learned from strong women. And then when he became an abolitionist, he encountered many strong women as well.
Yeah, they're in the book.
Yes.
First of all, the wife of the slave owner, Thomas Auld, Lucretia, was very kind to him.
Yes.
Their daughter, Sophia,
yes,
taught Douglas how to read.
Yes.
She was the first person who kind of tried educating him until she was kind of warned off.
That's right.
And then his friends and colleagues, friends in quotes,
yes,
a little more intimate than friends, Julia Phillips and Otelia Assing.
Yes.
And then later on, after Anna died, his second wife, Helen Pitts, white woman.
Yes, right. Well, Julia was Julia Griffiths rather than Julia Phillips, because that's the actress.
I'm sorry. Julia Phillips.
But another strong woman. But Julia Griffiths was instrumental in not only helping him start his newspaper, but she was instrumental in securing his freedom, formal freedom, because she raised the money to liberate him from Thomas Auld in 1846. And so she is responsible in a very important way for why he was able to return to America. Because in 1846, he was still a fugitive. And she came to America to help him. And because of that close connection, she was with him daily in his office. She was with him socially and lived with him because he insisted. There was a lot of rumors in Rochester that there was more than a friendship. And this got back to Anna. And there was...
Was that ever documented? Or is that something you kind of took there and ran with?
There is no smoking gun that says that they had an intimate relationship. And in the novel, they don't. But I do believe that he was in love with her and she was in love with him. But they wanted to protect their public image. But there was enough in the record. There was enough in the record that there was a lot of people who believed something was going on. And in fact, William Lloyd Garrison himself said in open in his newspaper that Douglas was changing his political, his views about abolition because of Julia, and there was domestic warfare going on in the Rochester house.
Oh, okay, even though he didn't really know.
Yeah, he just was taking rumor and making it public.
And that was basically to denigrate
Douglas. That's right. And again, it was also, I fundamentally believe, racist, because he wanted to raise the specter of Douglas having this relationship with a white woman.
Yeah.
And he knew
which
how volatile that, very
yeah,
inflammatory, and he knew it. But unfortunately, Douglas fed into it by forging a letter to the Liberator from Anna saying that there was no discord in the family because of Julia. And even Julia said he should not do this because it was known generally that Anna was illiterate. But he sent it off anyway. But what he didn't expect was Garrison was going to publish that letter in the Liberator. And then word got back to Anna that this letter was in the paper, and she confronted him. Now, how did that happen? I don't know. Douglas did say it happened, that there was
that's where the historical novelist,
because I wanted to imagine that confrontation. And so when summary is all that we have, then you have to decide, are you going to dramatize the summary? And that's what I do. I dramatize the summary of his reunion with Douglas, with Thomas Auld. I dramatize with dialogue, his three meetings with Abraham Lincoln. I dramatize the discussions that John Brown had with Douglas, because John Brown stayed at Douglas's house for weeks at a time. And all this, that's in the record, that these things happened and were said, but they were not dramatized in dialogue, because most often than not, 19th century writers did not tell their stories in dialogue. And I love dialogue. No, to be more seamless. Right. I had to learn that lesson as a writer.
Now, Sidney, you have a quote from James Baldwin as one of two epigraphs for the book. Quote, "History is not the past, it is the present. We carry our history with us. We are our history." I couldn't help thinking about, while reading, of events that happened during Douglas's time that reflect on what's happening in our country now. And an example in the book is the Dred Scott decision of 1857, a very famous Supreme Court case. I think we learned that in school, but maybe not all the ins and outs, which you get into in the book. And I found parallels with recent Supreme Court decisions, including the very recent one on presidential immunity, which seemed counter to the Constitution, even though that's the whole job of the Supreme Court. And even stretch the boundaries of not just law, but logic and rationality.
Yes.
And you do that with Dred Scott and the Chief Justice at the time, Roger Taney, who's kind of the Alito. I don't really regard our current Chief Justice as being in control, the Roberts Court. It's more the Alito Court.
Yes. I am very taken by what's happened with the Supreme Court recently, because I was also triggered in my recollections about the Supreme Court of the past. And I can honestly tell you, if you study the history of the Supreme Court, most of the Supreme Court over the years have aligned themselves with the rich and the powerful. Only on occasion does the Supreme Court stand up for the poor, for the weak, for those who do not have corporate power and wealth.
Taney apparently didn't start that way, but he went over to the dark side.
Yes, yes. Taney was a slaveholder, and eventually by 1857, the entire system of government, both the Congress, Senate, and the House of Representatives, also the presidents, and then the Supreme Court, aligned themselves with what Douglas called the slave power, which meant that it was clear to Douglas that by 1857 that slave owners were not going to willingly give up their power, and they used government as a way to reinforce that power. And in the Dred Scott decision, Dred Scott appealed for his freedom by going into the territories that banned slavery's extension. And it was called the Missouri Compromise of 1820. And because he went into that territory, he felt that he had become free and went to court to claim that freedom. And he won in the lower courts. But when it got to the Supreme Court and Roger Taney, it was reversed. And it was reversed.
And it went way beyond,
and way the, beyond scope, the scope of the case.
It wasn't Dred Scott. It was every black man in America.
Yes, he went not only declared that that Dred Scott was not a citizen. He went further and said all black people were not citizens and were not worthy of the protections of the U.S. government. But then he went further and said the Missouri Compromise passed by Congress was unconstitutional, and also that the government had no power to forbid the expansion of slavery into the territories.
And the result was the Civil War.
And there was no
going back.
Right, because what Taney did, he radicalized many Northern whites to wake up and realize that the government was a pro-slavery government. And there was no way that slavery was going to end without political intervention or worse. That's what energized even John Brown, who, however, Douglas rejected when Douglas was approached by John Brown to join him at Harper's Ferry.
Yeah, I want to talk about that too, because that's another issue that is still very relevant today. Change through violence or nonviolent resistance.
Yes.
And that's an age-old question, I think, not just in the U.S. in the 19th century or today. In the fight to end slavery, Douglass was caught in the middle. He didn't agree with the violent tactics, as you write in the book, of John Brown, or wholly agree with the nonviolent stance of abolitionists like William Lloyd Garrison, who had his own quirks. You write in the book that Douglass, quote, knew that violence was essentially a part of his life, that it was in his bones and blood, a part of his heritage and citizenship as an American, part of all our heritage, unfortunately, as Americans. Over 100 years later, not much has changed.
I found
we're no less violent.
Yes, I found Douglass's struggle with violence, because he lived with violence from his early childhood, starting with that cruel, vicious, unimaginable beating of his aunt by Captain Anthony. And he himself recognized his own capacity for violence. And also, it almost destroyed him in his adolescence when he was violently abused by Edward Covey for almost a year. So he understood the power and appeal of violence as revenge against injustice. But
also the dark side.
The dark side of
violence leads to more violence.
That's right. He understood that. And he realized that the perpetuation of violence, the cycle of that violent perpetuation had to be broken. So he found the pacifism, the moral persuasion of William Lloyd Garrison as very persuasive. However, in the 1840s, he went to the very first black convention for men, and it's depicted in the novel, and he heard a speech given by the remarkable but relatively unknown Henry Highland Garnett. And it was a speech calling for slave rebellion. And Douglass was enraptured by the speech, and he considered it the greatest speech he had ever heard. But when it came to publishing this speech, he, in the name of Garrison, made sure it was not published. And
Garrison asked him to cover it up.
Douglass himself said, this cannot go out because it's too powerfully persuasive. Because he felt, as a true Garrisonian, he had to do his part to prevent a call of violence to be publicized. That made Henry Highland Garnett, his enemy. And they stayed enemies almost for the rest of their
lives.
And
Douglass had a lot.
He had a gift for making enemies.
I think he said at one point in the book that the number of enemies you have are kind of the mark of your effectiveness.
Yes, that's exactly
of
right.
Your life.
And so what really fascinated me was he felt the appeal of violence, but he really saw its danger. And so when Garnett said, you need to meet John Brown, and he met John Brown.
And John Brown was
way ahead.
The spectrum of violence.
The spectrum of violence.
1 to 10, he was
11. Yeah. He was committed. And he basically said to Douglass, there's no other way that this is going to change without violence, because these people, these enslavers, will never willingly relinquish their source of their pride as well as their income.
And tragically, he was right.
And he was tragically right. But when Douglass started working to raise money for Garrison, for John Brown, he knew of Brown's plans to stir up a slave rebellion. And he supported that by raising money and calling people together to meet with John Brown. But when John Brown changed his plan in 1859
to raid a federal arsenal
at Harper's Ferry, Douglass said, no way.
Well, that also seemed like suicide.
It was suicidal. And if anyone who's been to Harper's Ferry, you can see with that confluence of those two rivers and that arsenal right there at the nexus of those two rivers, there is no way he could have escaped. And so some people may even suggest that John Brown knew that he was going to be a martyr. And when he was arrested, he made the most of his 6 weeks. He met with newspaper people.
He was definitely a fanatic.
He was definitely. But I don't think he was insane. I just think that he was a fanatic. But what was so admirable for people like Douglass, even though they were a bit miffed with Brown, who, for example, wrote an essay called Sambo's Mistakes, and
right,
he criticized black people for not being violent and aggressive enough. He was willing to die for freedom. He was willing to not only die for freedom, he was willing to sacrifice his own family.
A white man.
Yeah. Yes, a white man. And so that sent chills throughout the South. And when Harper's Ferry occurred, that's when the South became a military zone.
And they were already on high alarm, I think, 20 years before was the Nat Turner
that's
Rebellion.
Right.
And they were
that's
afraid
right.
that blacks would kill them in their sleep.
That's right. And so one of the things about all these laws that were passed was proof that they feared what eventually was going to happen. And there were slave rebellions. There were murders. There were people who said no. And they knew this. And so they had to suppress any vestiges of rebellion. And that was really interesting for me to discover that when Douglass was in Baltimore and discovered there was a paper called The Liberator, and everyone was afraid of any black person ever even discovering there was such a newspaper, it showed him again that people were afraid of language and the rhetoric of freedom.
The power of
words and language to stir people up. That reinforced his desire to use language against enslavers.
You asked a really good question at Powell's, which I think this blends into, other than why did you write it as a historical figure? somebody asked you what you thought was Douglass's greatest achievement, and you said it was transforming his life into art. And that was not just through the autobiographies, of course, but through speeches, his journalism, and maybe just the way he chose to live his life?
Yes, yes. He chose to make his life not only a literary masterpiece, but he chose to make his life representative of ideals and hopes and aspirations for everyone. And that's a double-edged sword, you know, when you choose to be representative, and because you're saying that everyone should emulate your life and follow your example.
Hard to do in Douglass's case.
And it's hard
you'd have to
do.
Be a genius, right?
Yes, who was a genius. And he was very charismatic. He was very self-aware of his image, which is why he embraced photography.
The most photographed man? I didn't know that.
Yes.
Of the 19th century.
Of the 19th century. Photographed all the time. And he always made clear what he looked like. And he always said for people that they need to follow his example and to aspire. And one of the things that saddened me is that in this appeal to be representative, he basically had to present an image that was altogether not true. And then also he led people to believe that if they aspire to his level of success and wealth, then black people would be accepted. And he called for black people in America to become professionals, to become successful. And we in our time know that that is simply not true. You could become president of the United States and still not be accepted. And so he was mistaken in that regard. And also when you choose to be representative, you're saying that everyone else, that you're almost implying that the future, the success of the tribe rests on the shoulders of one person. And we know that should not be the case. And in a society of white supremacy, we also know that if a white person fails, the tribe does not go with that failure. But when a black person or someone who is of a minority group, a marginalized group, often because of representation, that person is felt to be proof or validating of, see, I told you about those people, look. And that was the trap that Douglass put himself in. And he also, I have to admit that when he became successful, he had real troubles with the poor. He wanted the poor to be protected, but when he was around the poor or around the illiterate, he was not comfortable. when he went back to Maryland, he was clearly critical of people who were not educated.
Yeah, you talk about his brother in the book, Perry.
That's right.
And he kind of grudgingly accepts him.
That's right.
But the rest of the family
just thinks
Perry is kind of the low end of society.
That's right. He was uneducated. He was a former slave. But Douglas felt obligated to bring his brother Perry to Rochester. But it was very, very difficult, even for Frederick. And Anna calls him out. I imagine him calling him out and said, you built that separate house because you didn't want to be around your brother. And there's no proof that he felt.
But again, you're dramatizing something that you read.
That's right. Because what is in the record is that his children were openly hostile about their uncle. And he had to deal with that. And he tried to defend Perry, but Perry openly said, I cannot live in this house with the rest of the family. So when Douglas built that house, it was a relief for Perry. But then Perry ultimately decides to return to Maryland because the vibe in the Rochester house was just too negative for him, which was sad. And even Attilia, who was living in the house in the summers, was openly hostile to Perry and called him a leech.
Oh, she was from society.
Yes.
German society.
Yes, and was very German and very critical. And all that Frederick Douglass had to deal with domestically.
Well, Sydney, thanks so much for talking with us today. In the forward review, you mentioned a quote from Douglass that you wanted to include in the book but had to cut. I wonder if you could take us out by giving us that quote.
Yes. One of the most powerful and perhaps the most famous quote from the vast output of Frederick Douglass is a speech that I wanted to quote but had to cut from the text.
It didn't fit.
It just didn't fit the drama in the time this occurred. It was in 1857. He was giving a speech essentially about the emancipation of slaves in the West Indies. And in the context of that long speech, he says something that has perhaps become the most famous statement about change and process. And I wanted to quote it, but I had to leave it out because it didn't fit.
Here's your chance.
And so I'm going to read it because it still applies today.
Oh, yes.
To what we should know about not only what Frederick Douglass said, but what we should think about when we have to decide our own relationship to change, protest, and the desire for justice and freedom. And this is what Frederick Douglass said. If there is no struggle, there is no progress. Those who profess to favor freedom and yet deprecate agitation are men who want crops without plowing the ground. They want rain without thunder and lightning. They want the ocean without the awful roar of its many waters. This struggle may be a moral one, or it may be a physical one, and it may be both a moral and physical one. But it must be a struggle. Power can seize nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will. Frederick Douglass.
Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KABU Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show, we'd just like to hear it all again. You can stream this episode and previous episodes online at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, J-O-N-E-S-Y, or just search for it on the KABU website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guest today, Sydney Morrison, author of Frederick Douglass, a novel from Portland's Hawthorne Books. Sydney is currently on tour for the book with appearances scheduled in California, Washington, D.C., Maryland, New York, Ohio, Michigan, and Indiana. You can find out more about Sydney, his work, and all his upcoming events online at sydneymorrison.com. Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month, usually from 11 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, August 8th at 11 a.m. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying hope to see you all again then.